in world history, the point at which many societies in Afro-Eurasia turned from an emphasis on largely separate developments with connections with other regions, a peripheral activity at best, turned from this focus on the local and regional to an increasing focus on the benefits of connections, the possibilities of imitation, the possibilities of diffusion. And this was a pattern that would then, once the tipping point occurred, continue to accelerate from this juncture onward. There's another way to make the same point, and I do this tentatively, but it's worth consideration. There is a fairly straight line from the interregional connections that developed in the post-classical period to what we now view as globalization. Now, lots of apologies. Contemporary globalization is a lot quicker. It involves a lot greater volume in terms of trade connections. It involves far more extensive cultural interactions. So the post-classical period does not introduce globalization in the contemporary sense. But the straight line aspect is nevertheless noteworthy. People who traded and traveled and wrote about their activities in the post-classical period helped inspire people who would extend interregional trading activities still further later on, people like Christopher Columbus. And they, in turn, would feed great trading companies, new technologies that would spur travel and trade still further in the 19th century and on to contemporary globalization. There are historians, and we'll encounter them later in the course, there are historians who will argue this evolutionary approach, a pattern of interregional connections from the post-classical period blossoming steadily and gradually into globalization, that this is a wrong view. Globalization, in their eyes, is a much newer phenomenon, and we will have to deal with that. But remember this possibility. This is why the post-classical explosion of trade and travel really looms so large in world history. It's a different world by the 11th and 12th centuries in terms of the impact and involvement of many people, merchants, consumers, upper class leaders, the involvement of many people in a dependence on and enjoyment of contacts with distant places.
Lecture 14, Post-Classical Patterns of Imitation.
We're talking in this session, briefly I admit, about four different parts of the world during the post-classical period. We'll talk about Japan, we'll talk about Russia, we'll talk about Southeast Asia, and we'll talk briefly about Western Europe. The main focus is on patterns of imitation that these four areas conducted, usually fairly deliberately, with adjacent regions that were in some measurable senses better developed. They had older cultures, they had greater cities, they had greater prosperity, they had a more elaborate apparatus with regard to technology. We're touching base here with a number of key themes. Obviously, we continue the notion of interregional contacts, but now we're talking about slightly smaller distances than the ones we were referring to in the great system we discussed in the previous lecture. We're talking certainly about the spread of civilization. The parts of the world we're talking about today either had been outside the civilization orbit in the classical period, or at least only incompletely involved. And we're very definitely talking about an effort to make this expansion of civilization manageable and meaningful in a world history sense. We're talking without question about four places that were very different. Western Europe was different from Russia. Russia obviously different from Southeast Asia. Differences that would show up in cultural systems and religions, in at least the details of political systems, in specific trade patterns, all those things. So we're not talking about a nice, coherent package. But we are talking about something of a common process, and it's really an intriguing one, in which societies deliberately undertook activities that would bring them closer with adjacent, more prosperous societies without fully merging with them, but in a process that gives specific meaning to the notion of increasing convergence that we've introduced in previous discussions. The first case, and in some senses it's the easiest one because the process was so very explicit, the first case is that of Japan. Quite early in the post-classical period, Japanese leaders, princes, began to send student trips to China in order to learn more about Chinese ways and to bring their knowledge back to Japan proper. And this began a centuries-long flirtation between Japan and China, in which Japan would regularly organize expeditions several times a year to reach China in search of trade, but also in search of knowledge. And in the process, the Japanese developed a really impressive range of sectors in which they imitated China substantially, or at least in part. Obviously, there was technological imitation. The Japanese were able to learn new agricultural techniques from the Chinese, new manufacturing techniques that began to spur the increasing development of the Japanese economy. We don't necessarily want to argue that Japan became as sophisticated technologically as China was, but there was certainly interchange, and this was a pretty obvious aspect of the regular kinds of connections that developed between the two societies. The second area, and in some ways the more elaborate still, in which imitation had massive effects, were in the area of culture and cultural apparatus. In the first place, quite simply, the Japanese introduced the Chinese writing system. This was a system designed for a very different language. Japanese and Chinese remain very different as spoken languages. And over time, the Chinese ideographic system proved not fully appropriate for Japanese, and some other systems were developed, but they all built from this system, and the Chinese system was retained as well. So, simply put, though ultimately with some modifications, the Japanese got writing, one of the basic components of civilization, from the Chinese. They also incorporated a number of other cultural forms, adapting them, of course, to Japanese language and other conditions. They introduced many of the basic Chinese verse styles. They adapted Chinese martial arts. They adapted Chinese systems of very carefully regulated gardens. They adopted Buddhism extensively from China, ironically, adopting it more wholeheartedly than the Chinese would during the post-classical period as a whole. But with Buddhism from China also came architectural forms like the pagoda, the temple form, and a variety of other artistic themes that would connect Japanese art with Chinese. Cultural connections then were extremely substantial and helped shape a real blossoming of Japanese culture in a number of artistic areas. Chinese social ideas were adopted to a somewhat more limited extent. Among other things, for example, as Japan learned from China, the prestige of merchants began to decline slightly, although the Chinese downgrading of merchants in the Confucian system was never fully brought into Japan. Another interesting area involved gender relations. The Japanese did not import the full gamut of Chinese gender relations. Most notably, they did not import foot binding. But from the Chinese, they did learn that women were less equal to men than the Japanese had previously thought. So gender divisions tended to increase in Japan, though without reaching Chinese levels. There was an interesting footnote to this at some points in the post-classical period. Because Chinese culture was such an object of esteem, it was assumed that Japanese men should emphasize Chinese culture, which left Japanese writing actually to women for an interesting period of time. And among other things, the first novel ever written in the world, The Tales of Genji, was written by a Japanese woman in this period where it was all right for women to do this because the real prestige stuff was stuff being done in the Chinese manner by men. Social imitation then was significant, but obviously less complete than the kinds of connections that developed in culture and in technology. A final area, and an intriguing one, where the Japanese seem to have learned from the Chinese, involved attitudes toward the wider world. China, as is well known, tended to think of itself as the epitome of civilization, with all other societies viewed as inferior and barbarian. And the Japanese picked up something of this attitude by osmosis, obviously arguing that Japan in connection with China was a very special place, and little attention needed to be paid to the rest of the world. One world historian has actually wondered why Japan, in this period of clearly increased dynamism, didn't attempt a larger expansion effort, for example, possibly sailing into the Pacific. And we don't obviously know the answer. It's hard to answer historical negatives. But one reason may be that the Japanese were so focused on China, and through this to a sense that there was nothing to learn from other places, that the horizons were interestingly shaped and possibly interestingly limited. The second imitation example involves Russia and the Byzantine Empire. We've seen already how trade ran through Western Russia and Ukraine, what's technically known as Kievan Rus during this period, and connected it to the Byzantine Empire. Well, with trade obviously came other kinds of missions, and Russians frequently went to Constantinople for trading purposes, political missions, cultural exchange, that sort of thing. And Byzantine emissaries were active in Russia as well, missionary activity at the forefront. From these connections, Russia imported a variety of things from the Byzantine Empire. Cultural apparatus, again, was primary. The Russians got their writing system from the Byzantine Empire, from the Cyrillic adaptation of the Greek alphabet that was exported widely to East Central Europe, including Russia. Along with writing, the Russians, of course, got religion. The decision to emphasize Orthodox Christianity presumably involved this effort by Vladimir, the ruler of Russia, to distinguish among three options. Islam was rejected because it didn't allow alcohol. Western Catholicism was rejected because the Russians were worried about too much papal interference. That left the Orthodox faith, but frankly, there probably wasn't all that much choice. Given the Russian connections with Byzantium, this must have seemed quite obvious. Along with religion and writing came a wider cultural apparatus, conditioned only by the extent to which Russia was a less prosperous, less sophisticated urban society than Byzantium. But Byzantine architectural styles were widely imitated. Particularly interesting was the Russian adoption of the Byzantine tradition of iconography, of carefully worked paintings of saints, at which the Russians would ultimately become past masters, but which they did not, in fact, originate. Artistic, religious cultures widely imported, along with the basic apparatus of cultural transmission itself, the writing system. From the Byzantines also, Russian leaders incorporated at least some sense of political horizons. To the Russians, the Byzantine Empire was successor to Rome, and there could seem to be some sort of chain that connected Rome to Byzantium to Russia, and we will see this notion blossom in the next period of world history still more fully. Cultural imitation was primary, some technologies no doubt as well, but a political orientation was transmitted as well. Japan and Russia, two very different places, imitating two very different societies. Simply using China or the Byzantine Empire's models assure differentiation, nevertheless exhibit some striking similarities in terms of basic process. In each instance, various people in the imitating society feel that there's positive advantage not only in visiting but in copying aspects of the adjacent, more prosperous society. Cultural imitation seems to play a strikingly significant role, although other kinds of apparatus and ideas could be imported as well. And the process raises one other question that actually is crucial for the post-classical period and to some extent new in this period, but a question that we will have to deal with at various points from this juncture onward. The question is, how, now that civilization is expanding and now that societies are deliberately imitating each other, how do you define civilization? The Japanese case is probably particularly clear. Japan imitated China. It did not, however, become Chinese. It didn't or couldn't imitate fully. So, now that civilization has reached Japan as a form of human organization, do we need to talk about Japanese civilization as well as Chinese? Or can we talk about a larger East Asian civilization zone in which Chinese influences are primary, but in which other societies, not only Japan, but also Korea and Vietnam, sort of hover, participating in a number of common influences, including various aspects of cultural styles, including some exposure to Buddhism, certainly some exposure to Confucianism, but without becoming a clearly unified whole? It's a choice. You can answer either way. The advantage of seeing Japan as a separate civilization is you have to make fewer apologies. You have to back up less frequently and say, but don't forget Japan and China differed on this point. On the other hand, there's an obvious inefficiency. If we start labeling Japan a separate civilization, what do you do then with Korea and Vietnam? And how many civilizations do you end up with? And can you manage them? The efficiency of an East Asian civilization zone probably outweighs its drawbacks, but it clearly has drawbacks. It oversimplifies. A choice. The case of Russia is actually also intriguing, and we will have to encounter it later as well. World historians, frankly, have a good bit of trouble dealing with Russia because they don't quite know whether to say, well, it's part of European civilization because, after all, it becomes Christian, or is it part of a special Byzantine tradition, but it's not fully Byzantine? What do you do with it? My personal preference is to view Russia as a partial heir to a Byzantine East European tradition that will continue to distinguish it from Western Europe, thus two major civilization zones emerging in Europe, the West and the East Central East. But this is disputable, and among other things, it raises the question of where you draw the boundary line in East Central Europe. Among other things, it seems to fluctuate fairly often. So there's no fully happy resolution to this dilemma. The main point is to recognize it's a dilemma. Because imitation is becoming more important, the clear-cut boundary lines that separate one cultural zone from another are blurring. And we simply have to recognize that fact and recognize that some new kinds of choices, some new kinds of dilemmas emerge in consequence. The case of Southeast Asia is somewhat different. This was a period, the post-classical, in which a number of regional kingdoms emerged in Southeast Asia, in Thailand, in Burma, in parts of present-day Malaysia, and in parts of Indonesia. But at the same time, this was a region that received significant cultural and commercial influence from several other sources. Most important initially was, of course, India. And we've noted earlier that Indian traders reached into this region and sometimes brought with them Hinduism. The spread of Buddhism from India was even more striking. And from India also came inspiration to a number of regional writing systems, which were adapted, but nevertheless, which utilized the Indian model. So an Indian derivation remains extremely significant. But Chinese influence would come in as well, particularly in the form of increasing trade activity from the Song Dynasty onward. This, among other things, began to establish communities of Chinese merchants in certain parts of Southeast Asia. This would expand later on as well. So the Indian influence is modified by Chinese contacts, and then by the end of the post-classical period, a third stream of influence coming in the form of Islam and Islamic merchants, actually gaining the greatest religious success in many parts of this region of any of the three influences. This, then, Southeast Asia, is a region that clearly is an active recipient of outside influences, an active zone of commercial exchange and travel exchange, but in which the fact that several different influences combine with local traditions sets up a pattern that's rather different from the Japanese and Russian cases where there's a single model which the society has attempted to follow. Western Europe constitutes the fourth major case in the pattern we're discussing today. West Europe obviously needed some things less than Japan and Russia did from its potential inspirers. It already had an alphabet inherited from classical Rome. It already had, through missionary activities early in the post-classical period, it already had a religion, although in one sense this religion is borrowed. It's not native to Western Europe, as is well known. But West Europe did see the advantage. West European leaders of various sorts, political, cultural, and economic, did see clear advantages in imitating contacts both with the Byzantine Empire and with the Arab world. In part, as is quite well known in medieval European history, it utilized these contacts to regain knowledge of classical learning, scientific and philosophical, particularly literary to some extent, because the Byzantines and the Arabs preserved Hellenistic and Roman knowledge better than had been the case in West Europe itself. But imitating the classics via these models is really not the main point. From the Muslims and from the Byzantines, West Europeans also imitated a variety of technologies, and the eagerness of West European technological imitation becomes a striking aspect of the post-classical period. It imitated scientific concepts. Again, partly these were derived from Greek and Hellenistic work, but Europeans also benefited very directly from Arab advances in medicine, in mathematics, and in other fields. The West Europeans borrowed philosophically. The Arab debate over the boundaries between faith and reason was a debate that was transmitted back into Europe, where it made a great deal of sense in terms of Christian interests in rationalism as well. There was significant borrowing in the area of art. The Gothic arch, that quintessential artistic symbol of post-classical Western Europe, was in part adapted from the characteristic Islamic arch. The engineering principles were essentially the same, and the stylistic features very similar. Legal imitations also occurred. West Europe borrowed extensively from Islamic innovations in commercial law, among other things, learning that one could identify certain principles of commercial law that could transcend political boundaries and help protect merchants regardless of specific location. The West European debt, in other words, whether acknowledged or not, to Islamic and Byzantine example was considerable. This is not a case exactly like that of Japan and Russia. The imitation is a little more diffuse. Two societies are being utilized, not just one. But the notion of this as an extensive period of Western imitation is an important addition, or at least a heightened emphasis, for our view of post-classical Western Europe in this larger world history period. And we need to talk, as we will next time, we need to talk about what this partial revision does to our sense of the emergence of Western civilization more generally. The imitation process, going back to the general phenomenon, raises one final question that's actually intriguing for the period itself and possibly carries some interesting implications even for more contemporary situations. We've stressed, particularly with Japan and Russia, but really for all four cases, we've stressed the extent to which, along with technologies, cultural forms and styles seem to have been particularly eagerly sought. And one wonders why. Were these simply what were most impressive about the societies when student groups or merchants visited? The great buildings, the great artistic works, the polished literature? Or was there a need, as these new civilization regions were beginning to get going in the civilization process, was there a need first to establish some cultural bases before other things could be done? Because the striking omission from the pattern of imitation, though not for want of trying, was significant capacity to imitate the model in the area of politics. And here we need to go back to three separate stories, those stories with ultimately the same point. Japan, Russia, and Western Europe were keenly aware that political models existed that were considerably superior to their own decentralized political situation. As Japan began to imitate China, there was a deliberate and, frankly, quite understandable desire to import the Chinese imperial system. After all, Japanese princes were sponsoring the student voyages. They surely wished to enhance their own political power. What better than to introduce a powerful notion of emperor, a powerful bureaucracy supplemented by Confucianism? So for the better part of a century, the Chinese example was widely incorporated into Japanese political activity, but the effort failed. Japan simply could not at that point sustain that degree of centralization. Mountain and island barriers possibly impeded, lack of political experience and legitimacy possibly impeded, but as Japan successfully imitated aspects of Chinese culture, economic activity, social forms, it notably departed from Chinese example in politics. And the Japanese solution during the bulk of the post-classical period would be a form of feudalism, a form of relationships between regional lords and vassals that led to a great deal of internal warfare, could be utilized to construct some larger political patterns, could be utilized to inspire larger systems of loyalty that many people have argued are extremely influential in Japanese history since that point, but which definitely did not generate anything like the Chinese political model. Russia, as we've already noted, Russian leaders were keenly aware of Byzantine political example, and Russian rulers were capable of pronouncements that could make them sound like junior league Byzantine autocrats. So they could say, my subjects will do this, my subjects will convert to Christianity, as though they wielded the power of a great imperial bureaucracy. They did not. Russia had central rulers during much of the post-classical period, some initially perhaps imported from Scandinavia, but they did not establish a tightly organized political system. There was a great deal of looseness, a great deal of negotiation and horse trading between the ruler and local aristocrats. This was a decentralized political system, despite the existence of a clear centralized political model. And the West European case, broadly speaking, is just interestingly similar. The West Europeans had one clear shot at a more centralized, coordinated political structure, and this shot occurred under Charlemagne in the early 9th century. Charlemagne was clearly aware of the Roman Empire's example, but he was also aware of the Byzantine Empire and of the Arab Caliphate, and there was a clear interest in developing a large central kingdom or empire, and Charlemagne's realm extended to northern Italy, very northern Spain, through France, the Low Countries, and parts of western Germany. It was an impressive geographic amalgam. And briefly, it looked like Western Europe might beat the odds and, at an early phase of its development, managed to create a substantial and possibly sophisticated political structure. But like the Japanese effort with China, this attempt failed. Charlemagne lacked the resources and possibly the experience to set up a really independent bureaucracy. He ended up reinforcing West European feudalism, which was a system interestingly similar to that which was the Japanese fallback. Charlemagne's heirs, his grandsons, split his realm into three, hinting at the later development of France on the one hand, Germany on the other, and then an intermediate territory that would always be something of a no man's land, embracing the Low Countries, Switzerland, northern Italy, etc. And the effort simply foundered. West Europe during the post-classical period emerged as yet another society in which loose political structures, loose political rule predominated. So, obvious question. Is this somehow a logical pattern in which societies that prove quite capable of imitating aspects of other societies' cultures and who use this imitation rapidly to speed up artistic, literary, and cultural development, are these simply inherently less able to utilize political example? Does culture have to come first? Is there a period of political gestation necessary before a society can imitate another society's political achievements? And if this is so, is this a case in point that still applies in the world today? We have a number of instances in the world today in which societies seek or are told to seek a political inspiration from societies who have